Welcome to the Gottesdienst crowd, where we foster confessional integrity, liturgical preservation, and preaching that doesn't stink. We believe that the historic liturgy of the divine service is more than mere cobwebs of antiquity, but it is a true treasure of the church to be dusted off and brought down from her attic to be enjoyed. So let's get dusting.
Welcome back to the Gottesdienst crowd. This is Jason Broughton. Today we have with us a special guest from Moscow, Idaho. It's Dr. Joe Rigney. He's the fellow of theology at New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho, and an author, a prolific author of many books. So thanks for coming on, Joe.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you have a new book out, Leadership and Emotional Sabotage. This is not the first book that I came across, and it's obviously not the first book that you've written. I know you've written a number, but the first book that I came across, which I think, and I've used quite a bit, at least in helping to describe, using narrative or engaging the imagination to get at people's will is a lot more effective than just like giving them commands. One of the things that I love about the book, not only the recent book, but also this book called Live Like a Narnian, Lessons from C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, is that you do this so well. You point out kind of engaging the imagination of the Christian that Lewis is doing for our own lives. And one chapter in particular, chapter 10, I think, called Shasta's Hard Lesson, where you kind of outline how, Lewis points out that often we are rewarded by doing one good deed, by being given another one that is more difficult and far better. And we're always wondering, like, why does it seem so hard? Why is it difficult? And we miss out on the biblical principles of the greatness of difficulties, not just that they are big and seemingly overpowering, but great in what the Lord does through them. So why is that so important to engage the imagination in that manner?
Yeah, that's good. I think we are creatures who find ourselves in a story. God is a storytelling God. And we're creatures, we're characters in the story that he's telling. And therefore, one of the ways to address us that's really fitting and appropriate is through stories. So this is why stories are, the Bible's filled with stories, both historically true ones, like sort of the narratives of scripture, but also it itself contains fictional stories that are meant to shape and mold how people think about themselves. So you think of something like Nathan and telling that little parable to David in order to awaken the king's emotions and sense of outrage and injustice in order to then drop the hammer of you are the man. Or you think of the Jesus and his parables and various things like that. So we are storytelling creatures because we are creatures who live in stories. And so I think that great literature has this capacity to do it. It gives us a language of images. It gives us characters in the stories that we read. It kind of frames our experience. It's why the books you read do matter, because they shape how you see yourself and how you see the world around you. And so Live Like a Narnian was my first book, and it was probably the one that was most fun to write, because this is what I do for a living is I teach theology and I teach literature. And so here I am reading these, children's books, these fairy tales, and trying to say, actually, there's some really profound things happening here. And that example you gave of Shasta is one, because there at one level, the lesson that Lewis draws, he actually puts it in there as a statement. Shasta had not yet learned that if you do one good deed, your reward usually is to be set to do another and harder and better one. Like, that's the lesson. And so you could just give that to a student, but by embedding that lesson in this narrative of Shasta's journey north and all of the trials that he came through and all of the effort that he goes through as he's running from the lions and he's trying to warn the king of of this invading army. And then he makes it barely. And then he's like, go, you got to go do it again. And you're not done yet. That mm-hmm. kind of contextualizes it. It incarnates in some way the lesson itself. And so we begin to see ourselves in Shasta's shoes, which then shapes, okay, well, what's the equivalent in my life of this thing? It has color, it has texture. It's not just a bland proverb, because proverbs mm-hmm. can be bland. And that's actually, right. funny enough, that's Horse and His Boy. This is one of the points Lewis makes about, you know, sort of Kalorman proverbs are really, really awful. Like they're really abstract and they're just not very good. Like they don't pack a punch. Whereas the Narnian ones tend to be very, you know, more poetic, involve more metaphor, more images. And so Lewis is sort of showing and telling in this story about the importance of embedding truth in poetic, metaphorical, fictional ways.
Yeah. So it sort of seems like when you're discussing this, you say, you're promoted, right? You should see in this a promotion, not a discipline in terms of how we often think of discipline, which is as a negative right. thing, as a punishment, but rather as a discipline in the sense that, look, you've been given something more, something extra, kind of the way St. Paul talks about, you know, all of his things in his sufferings and his beatings in 2 Corinthians, that he's content mm-hmm. in them. He delights in them. And mm-hmm. if we don't begin to see, like start getting a wry smile every time difficulty comes around, to think, okay, how's God promoting me, and for what greatness and for what great end does he have in store here, and what's the plan unfolding? We should begin to look at those things like that, shouldn't we?
Yeah, right, exactly. And I think this is where having the stories of Scripture sort of deep in our bones, because when hardship comes, there are sort of multiple stories it could be. So I wouldn't mm-hmm. want to rule out that the hardship you're facing might actually be disciplinary in the punitive sense. This is God chastising you for some sin, because right. that is a biblical story, right? So and when mm-hmm. when things started going wrong in Israel and they're, you know, being oppressed by the Canaanites, they should have gone, you know, I think it's because we've been worshiping idols and we should knock that right. off. And so there is a place for like learning to read the story you're in. But part of the challenge is that we tend to be simplistic and have a very, there's only one story. And mm-hmm. there's only one possible story. So if bad things happen, it's just, this is Deuteronomy. This is the curse. I'm receiving this because of chastisement. It's that sort of the Job's friends coming upon him, and they're like, well, he's got, you know, diseases, everything, all these bad things have happened to him. He must have done something really evil to deserve all of this. Mm-hmm. And Job is going, that's not what's happened. I've checked. I've looked, and as far as I can tell, I've not done anything to offend God. The biblical author is agreeing with Job in this and saying he didn't sin. He didn't, you know, he was blameless. And so they've got a simplistic story that they're trying to impose on him. And Job is sort of asserting for most of the book, that's not the story I'm in. There has to be some other reason. And I wish God would show up, because I'd like to ask him mm-hmm. what that reason is. And so as Christians who have the full Bible, we're able to kind of go, okay, when this hard thing happens, is this a chastisement meant to lead me to repentance? Or is this a challenge? Is this a trial that's meant to help me overcome it? Because this is, like you said, this is a promotion. This is, congratulations, you've graduated from kindergarten and you get to go to first grade. Well, guess what? First grade's harder. Yes. You thought kindergarten was hard, but first grade's even harder. And when you get done with first grade, you know what? It's actually going to be harder. It's going to be second grade. And this is the way that God grows us up into maturity, by giving us greater challenges, by helping us to grow in our faith, to trust him more deeply, and then to do the work, to do the actions that he's requiring of us, in response to that challenge.
Yeah. And there is a certain sense in which, you know, even recognizing that maybe it's not disciplinary in the punitive sense, mm-hmm. but a promotion, there is a sense in which, you know, when we chafe under that promotion, like what did we expect? You know, didn't Jesus say that, you know, the way was narrow and difficult, and were we expecting a life of ease? And so in a sense, there is sort of a disciplinary, perhaps not punitive, but at least calling us out of this mindset of trying to get to the life of ease instead of the life God has actually planned for us.
That's right. And it's kind of, First Peter has that great line where Peter says, don't be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you. Like,
right.
So don't, when the hard thing comes, don't go, what in the world? I had no idea. This wasn't even on my radar. Jesus tells us this is precisely what you should expect. And I think that's relevant because, to connect it to the more recent book, the Leadership and Emotional Sabotage book that just came out. I think leaders sometimes can think, okay, I'm leading faithfully, and therefore things ought to go well.
Right.
When in reality, it's if you're leading faithfully, you ought to expect some sabotage. You ought to expect some challenge. Jesus, this is, blessed are you when people say all kinds of false things about you. Rejoice and be glad that you're in good company. And there's a notion of when all of a sudden you're like, man, I'm being faithful, and all these people are saying lies about me. And what did Jesus say in that moment? No self pity, no moping, no sulking, but instead rejoicing. Good God, I double check, make sure this isn't that there's no truth to these false accusations. Okay, there's not. Great, this is God's blessing. God says this is a blessing for me, and to lean into it and welcome it, and not to be deterred or derailed or taken off mission by it.
Yeah, and in this new book, I think you make it. You said it earlier that we can be overly simplistic to think that we're in just one story, and the flip side of the punitive discipline is that somehow God is not involved in the other side, that everything needs to go well, and if I must be doing something wrong, and then we begin to become almost like mathematicians or practitioners of some sort of formula to try, well, I must have the wrong formula or the wrong thing, instead of this is the response to being faithful.
Right. Yeah, exactly right. So we can, and this is back to the imagination thing. Your imagination narrows. The range of options of what God could be doing in your life become very narrow, and you get stuck. And that stuckness then becomes it's a paralysis that you can't sort of get out of, because your expectations of how this ought to go have not been met. And this is precisely the value of both faithful, diligent knowledge of the scriptures, knowing what stories does God like to tell, but then also the way that other literature can come in and illuminate your circumstances and give you some hooks, give you some categories, give you some frames to understand why these things might be happening, and therefore what should you do next? Because I think that's often the thing that I think where our orientation should go is, it's one thing to say, okay, these things are happening to me, but the question is, what does God want me to do? What's the next thing that He wants me to do? And sometimes the stories that we're telling ourselves, the expectations we've created, turn us into victims where we don't do things; things happen to us, as opposed to saying, okay, well, I can't control what happens to me. I don't have, and I think this is a big part of like our modern anxieties is that felt sense of how little we actually do control, like that. We don't control the course of human events. We don't control very much at all. And so that can create anxiety because we want to. And I think sometimes our modern mentality of our technologies trick us into thinking we can control more than we can. And instead, what's needed is a more biblical, grounded sense of, I can't control the events that happen to me. I can't control what other people do. But what is under my control in some respect, what I am responsible for is what I do and what God has entrusted to me. So I'm responsible for myself. I'm a husband and father. Therefore, I'm responsible for my family. I'm a minister in a church. Therefore, I'm responsible for my flock. I'm a professor at a college. Therefore, I'm responsible for my students. Like I do have responsibilities, things that I can influence and do. But fundamentally, the first and foremost thing is I'm responsible for me. And so how do I respond to this hardship? How do I how do I respond to this persecution? If it's from another person, or if it's a Job-like, you know, natural disasters have fallen upon us. My response is the thing that God has placed into my hands. And therefore that's what I should seek to steward well.
Yeah. What I loved about this book is, one, it talks about leadership, but it doesn't devolve into kind of that kind of saccharine, sappy kind of leadership that is often kind of, you know, put out these days. And it's not overly business-minded, even though I do think we can, you know, plunder the Egyptians in that regard and take some of the things that the business world has learned. But it is deeply rooted in the scriptures and in other stories. And you kind of hold into tension, I think, what you just said, which is, you know, we don't control everything, but we have more agency than we often give ourselves credit for.
That's right. That's right. And that is what, you know, I hadn't quite thought about the new book in the terms of how much I did rely on sort of biblical narratives to make the points that I did. But like a big part of what I guess I was doing was, okay, I need you to see yourself in Adam in the garden. What was he doing? And therefore, what was his failure? I need you to see yourself. Okay, you're Aaron at the golden calf, and the people who have been traumatized by this experience they've been through are agitated and distressed at Moses' absence, and they just want to feel safe. And they're asking you to make them idols to go before them and protect them, because that's what the Egyptians had and that's what they want to have too. And now you're Aaron, faced with the distressed people. What do you do? And so I get in that frame, see yourself in the story and go, okay, now do you see why Aaron did what he did? Now do you see why he buckled? Why did he abdicate in the way that he did? And then conversely, you know, there's other stories. You know, the encounter at Antioch, I think, is with Peter and Paul is a really profound one in that respect, precisely because it's a really dense passage. It's like only, you know, 8 verses or something like that. But there's a whole host of wisdom in it. If you think what actually is happening here when you have Jews and Gentiles and sort of different missions to different groups. And then, but you've got the gospel, which is making one new people. And then you've got this external pressure from opponents of the gospel who are persecuting, you know, there's persecution happening in Jerusalem, and that's having effects on the leaders in Jerusalem, who then send messages to Peter saying, hey, this might be causing some problem. Maybe you could back off a little bit, not eat with the Gentiles anymore until things calm down. And again, some of that is me speculating on the rationale, but it's trying to really understand what, given what we know from the Bible about the early church, how does Peter's hypocrisy make sense? Like, what would have led him as the guy who you know, God told, hey, the Gentiles are in, what would lead him to withdraw? And the text tells us it was fear. It was fear of the circumcision party. It was fear of these Jewish people who were going to persecute him, or who were persecuting others, perhaps, because of his actions. And therefore, he becomes a hypocrite out of fear. And then Paul has to come in and say, no way, no how. I'm going to put my foot down. I'm going to take action. I'm not just going to be another domino. And once you begin to see those dynamics, you begin to see them everywhere. You begin to realize the ways in which in your own church or your own family or whatever, your own business, the way that, you know, stuff that goes on far distant from you can kind of be channeled into your inner circle by, you know, emotional pressure and emotional sabotage every step along the way. And that person gets steered, and then that person gets steered, and eventually it arrives at you, and you have to decide, am I just going to be one more person who gets steered out of fear, or am I going to be like Paul and be sober-minded and decisive and say, no, the gospel is at stake here. You can't do this, and I'm going to oppose it. I'm going to resist it and try to turn the tide. So that's leadership, right? So it is interesting to think about the way that these biblical stories really do display and provide models that instruct us so that we can better read our own story.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really great point, because so often we will read the scriptures, I mean, even as pastors, as like we look at a text. So we're on lectionary in my church body. So we're on lectionary, and so we look at what can I squeeze out of this text to make a sermon, to talk for however long I need to talk, instead of letting it really work on us and see ourselves in that text to do what even Luther does so often, which is, you know, say, you know, you should see yourself in the ours and the my's and the we's of the biblical stories.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, they're inviting you in. They're inviting you to, they're shaping your imagination because that's how you're going to faithfully live.
Yeah. So let's dive into the book itself. And this comes from other stories too, right? Your the story of Odysseus standing on the shores of Troy, a Shakespearean image that he puts forward. What what made you want to begin there? What was it about that story that you thought this really does illustrate what I want to talk about?
Yeah. So, you know, I teach theology and literature and have for over a decade or so, and Shakespeare is one of my favorites. And the speech from Odysseus from Ulysses in Troilus and Cressida is really a profound analysis of social fragmentation. Like, how do societies fall apart? What leads to that? And it's embedded in a story in which you have an army that ought to have been able to destroy Troy, and yet 7 years in has been unable to do so. And so the question for these guys is, why not? And it's interesting because to connect it to the Shasta thing, their first answer is, well, it's because the gods are testing us. The gods are trying to show who the true men are. And so they've sent hardship into our lives in order to test us in this way. And, and yet Ulysses comes along and says, actually, the reason that we've been unable to do so is more complicated than that. It has to do with more of an inner dysfunction. There's something wrong. There's something rotten in the camp. The Greek army has a disease, and that disease is rooted in the abdication of its leaders. And that abdication then leads to the proliferation of rivalries and factions, which causes the social order to unravel. And Ulysses kind of gives this really profound analysis about the way that social order is maintained. And it's maintained. The word he uses is the word degree, which he means something like, it's like, it functions like gravity. It's the reason, it's an invisible force that binds things that are unlike together. And he says degree can be concealed, covered over, it can be shaken, it can be untuned, it can fall to chaos. And when it does, everything becomes unraveled and you get social disorder. And so I've taught that for years. And so then when having been influenced, as the book is, you know, influenced by Edwin Friedman's work on leadership, I just remember seeing for years, like the connection between these two kind of analyses and wanting to say, hey, Shakespeare is showing us in his play what Friedman is describing in his sort of psychological social analysis. And I want to bring those together because I think they're onto something and say the Bible actually gives us sort of the primal example of this, where abdication of leadership leads to great sin and then excuse making, blame shifting, and then chaos. Obviously Adam and the garden do that. And then you just see that pattern play out again and again throughout the scriptures. So that's kind of like, wanting to kind of, I love Shakespeare, and it was at some level, it was like, I don't know if I can improve on this analysis. And so I'm just going to kind of unpack this speech as a way of, as a lead in to say, do you see this around you? Do you see this angst in the air? Do you feel the unraveling? Do you feel the anxiety? The social disorder, kind of everything feels like it's coming apart. And if you do, where'd it come from? Well, abdication of leaders is a pretty good place to start.
Yeah. So that's a refrain throughout. The abdication leads to idolatry or great sin, you know, a great failure of nerve, and then blame shifting and more of the same, right? It just is like this spiral downward.
Yes.
What are the, later you put this into the three estates, or what we would call the three estates, the home, the church, and society. What are the correctives to the problem with the degree or the problem with abdication? What are the things that we should take note of? And then, I don't want to say do the opposite, but make the correction.
Yeah, I think, you know, at each of those levels, you know, you mentioned that trifecta of, you know, Adam abdicates, he's passive when the serpent tempts his wife. And then she falls into sin and offers some to her husband. And then he listens to the voice of his wife. So he commits idolatry. He puts her in place of God. That's the great sin, the idolatrous sin. And then when it's time to face judgment, God comes down and said, "What have you done?" He says, "Well, the woman you gave me, it's her." He blames her. He passes the buck. And this sort of pattern of Adamic masculinity, Adamic leadership, shows up in Aaron and Golden Calf. I use Saul and the Amalekites because it's the same story. It's history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And so it's the same story. At each of those stages, what was needed was for Adam to take responsibility. At a base level, it was when the serpent's tempting his wife, what should he have done? When the serpent lies to his wife, he's the head. He's responsible for himself and for this body, this new household. He should have stepped up to the plate and said, "No," right? He should have intervened. That would have been taking responsibility. But say he failed at that first spot and he didn't take. He still was passive. Once she sins, once she's eaten the fruit and offers it to him, he still needs to take responsibility and say, "No, I can't do that. I got to be faithful to God, even if you've not been. I'm going to trust God, even if you haven't been." And then, had he done so, and God shows up and says, "What's going on here?" And he says, "She ate the fruit." Adam should have taken responsibility and said, "Kill me, not her."
Right.
Right. Take me instead, God. Instead, he says, "Kill her, not me." He should have said, "Kill me, not her." And we say, how do we know that? Well, it's like, well, that's what Jesus did. Jesus comes upon a bride under a death curse because we've sinned. And Jesus says, I'll go instead. The head will die for the body. And then this is God's mercy and kindness. And I think had that alternative story played out and Adam offered himself in that way, God would have done something miraculous and marvelous in order to deliver it. I don't know. What would it look like? I don't know. Don't speculate too far. But what we ought to do is every step along the way, take responsibility for yourself and your own actions, in order to be a faithful leader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the first counteractive is to take responsibility.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Which part of what that requires, the virtue that I commend, you know, more than anything in this book is the virtue of sober-mindedness, which is an interesting virtue because it's one of those ones. I know growing up in the church, you know, it kind of shows up in various lists of like, hey, be sober-minded or whatever. And you never really think about it. I think as a kid, probably always thought of it as kind of dour-faced, you know, like like probably confusing somber and sober.
Like a German Lutheran.
Exactly. Like a German Lutheran, right? Maybe a Swedish Lutheran. I don't know. But like probably that, so. that was sort of the vision that I had of it. Now as a 40-year-old, I'm like, oh no, what it is sober-mindedness. It's not the opposite of joyfulness or glad-hearted. Instead it's steadiness. It's groundedness. It's a sense of, I'm not tossed to and fro by my passions. My passions don't run my life, nor do the passions of other people run my life. Other people's passions, I'm not afraid of them. They don't steer me. I care about them. If you know, my wife's upset or if my kids are upset, like I'm responsible for that and care about it, but that's not governing me. I'm not, the language I use in the book is it's sober, right? So don't get drunk on passions, your own or other people's. And it's that virtue that allows a leader to have kind of the necessary emotional distance to not be sort of sucked in and pulled into the angst and anxiety that surrounds him. It's that that enables him to kind of go, okay, what does God want me to do here? What's necessary? What's good? What will be a blessing here? As opposed to simply being tossed about by whatever emotion happens to be most dominant, anger or fear or desire or, you know, envy or whatever emotion is kind of raging in the moment. And you can just get pulled along with that. And instead to say, no, I'm stepping out of that. And I'm going to say, what does this situation need? And the fundamental thing it needs is the grace of God. And you as the leader are the vehicle that God intends to bring into this body, into this system, and say, bring some stability and some steadfastness and some groundedness to kind of anchor people, in the truth.
So how does that work in terms of mechanics, I guess? So you notice that you have these passions and it doesn't, I never got the impression that you were saying be dispassionate or a lack, right. you know, a passionate, but to ensure that those were not in the driver's seat. And oftentimes, you know, we can't, you know, our minds can't necessarily contend with a negative. Like, you know, if we're concentrating on not doing something, we end up doing that thing more than if we concentrate on what we ought to be doing. So what's the right. thing that we ought to be doing when we notice kind of those red flares of whatever the passions are that might be trying to steer us? What are the things that we should be focusing on?
Yeah, well, I think just even to start there, though, I think one of the most common counsels that I give, and it's in the book and it comes out of it, is learning to pay attention to your passions, because they often are telling you something. It is an information source. And you say, what do you mean by pay attention to your passions? Well, pay attention to your reluctances, to your hesitations, to your frustrations, you know, to your, when we say, I feel stressed, whenever our emotional state begins to rise, are you dialed in, and can you kind of look at them and go, what's underneath it? Where's that coming from? And that's the first step, because that's what allows you to step outside and not just get sucked into the system and become another domino that gets knocked over. So the first is to kind of have some self-awareness, some self-knowledge. And then, having done so, you know, God intends for, you know, He rules over us, and our mind rules over our passions, our what we know to be true and what we know to be good ought to be a governor. And passions are not, they're like unruly children in that they need to be stewarded and shepherded, or, you know, maybe they're like sheep, if you want to use that image, but they need to be sure. shepherded. So it's not the sort of thing where you can simply snap your fingers and make yourself feel a certain way. We know that. We don't have that capacity, but it is the sort of thing where you can steward and shepherd them by directing your attention, by reminding yourself of certain truths, by exposing what lies you might have been believing that were provoking that reaction. What expectation wasn't getting met that caused you to be so angry when your wife made that comment? How are you framing this whole situation? And begin to interrogate, and then to reframe it, reframe the situation, reframe what do I know to be true here? And then now, having reframed it, I can re-enter in, and what does God want me to do, say? And this is where, you know, if it's a family, for example, in the book, I try to highlight, you've got a lot of tools in your tool belt. You know, you've got, so you got some angst in your home. There's some crackle in the room. Well, what has God given you? Well, He's given you, you should instruct and teach your family. You can warn. You know, you see some danger coming. You see a teenager who's beginning to go down a path, and you want to sort of anticipate where the temptations they're going to face. So you give them a warning. Or maybe they've already started down that path, and now you're not warning them. You're rebuking or correcting them. Or maybe if they've already done something egregious, you discipline them, and you have a more of a punitive. Or on the positive side, it's encouragement and praise that you're trying to do. So you have all of these different tools as a human, as a person, in your tool belt that you can bring to bear. And part of leadership is learning what tool is appropriate for this situation and this person. But in order to even have any clue about that, you have to be able to be aware of your own passions, step out of the stream, and get a grip on yourself, so that you act with purpose and you're not just reacting. Like that's a big part of where things go wrong, is when leaders just become reactive. Whatever happens, it's reaction, 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 reaction. And therefore it's just churning in the system more and more anxiety and social stampedes and all of these things, because the leader ought to be a shock absorber who takes the angst and buries it, and therefore is able to reorient the whole body.
Yeah, there's this great book by a former FBI negotiator called Never Split the Difference, Chris Voss. Yeah. Yes. And he does a really great job. I think, you know, there's a lot of stuff that he talks about that would be helpful within homes and even the pastoral ministry. And just in terms of, look, it's not necessarily the person that's the enemy or the problem. It's the situation. Mm-hmm. And just coming to grips with the fact that you've got emotions in that. What are those emotions? What are they telling you? And what's the best course in terms of discussing that, so that, not that you can compromise, because that's a bad deal, according to him, but that you're faithful.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. His I've not read his book, but I've seen some interviews and videos with him. Mm-hmm. And the way that he talks about kind of the reframing of the issue is a really wise thing. Like one of my basic kind of premarital or even marital counseling kind of advices is when you find yourself building a wall between, when there's a wall going up between husband and wife, the first order of business, you know, like Reagan said, is to tear down that wall.
Right.
Because that, like it is, insofar as you're viewing the other person as your opponent, then that's the first issue. Because what you need to do is reframe it as we're collaborating on a common problem because we're together. Right. We're one flesh. We are one. We are a unit. We are one. We're individuals, but we're united into a single one flesh union. And therefore, this is our problem. I can't say that you are my problem. Like, this is our problem, right? You have to reframe it that way. And actually, one of the funny things about that is even just making that effort in marital problems, in a normal marriage where you got normal sinners sinning in normal ways, when you can just kind of say, hey, wait, time out. I think that we're viewing each other as the problem instead of the problem as the problem. Let's reframe it. And then shoulder to shoulder, let's readdress it. How can we actually, go for the win-win, to use the kind of negotiator thing that Voss talks about. How do we get the win-win here? That reframing sometimes is all it takes to dial down the angst. And now you can think clearly. Now you can act with purpose. Now you can say, well, we need to do this and that. And all of a sudden things become more plain because you're not clouded by the emotion.
Mm-hmm. So sober-mindedness, once we deal with that, right? So dealing with our own emotions and not letting those passions rule us, but letting God rule our minds through his word, and then our minds ruling over us. Mm-hmm. What's that, for lack of a better way of saying it, next step?
Yeah. Well, one of them would be, I think that sober-mindedness enables a kind of curiosity. So that's where now you can actually ask questions and get outside your own, stuckness. When we're highly emotional, we tend to be very narrow. Like the world shrinks because emotion has a way of doing that for us. And that can be really helpful in certain contexts. It's how you stay alive. Right? You know, the adrenaline kicks in, emotions come on, and that's how you survive that harrowing experience. But when you're trying to make a good and wise decision about something that requires more planning, the emotion can cloud. And so enabling curiosity, so being able to step out of the anxiety of the moment and ask questions to try to better understand what you're dealing with, that's one thing that would be a next step. I think the other, though, is often just acting. Like, sometimes what's needed is just decisive movement in a particular direction, a purposeful direction, not a reactive flinch, but here's where we're going and everybody come with me. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's enough to kind of settle the system. And it doesn't mean that you necessarily even made the right initial call. One of the values of sober-mindedness is it allows for course correction. If you take four steps down a particular path and realize, this was a bad idea. If you're steady and sober-minded, you can say, well, let's just turn left now and get back on track. And it doesn't have to be a world-ending thing. When it's highly emotional and highly charged, then you just ping-pong back and forth between let's go here and let's go here and let's go here. I think the other thing that it allows is it does enable, I found that sober-mindedness enables playfulness, which I say in the book, again, following Edwin Friedman, playfulness is one of the most important signs of health, I think, in a given community, whether it's a household, whether it's a church or an office, the ability, and because playfulness is usually a sign of high trust, of humility, of security. And so it's an indicator of those things. So a team, a pastoral team, or a family that's unable to laugh together, joke together, play together, but is always deadly serious, is usually one that is highly, highly dysfunctional and unhealthy. There's something that's gone wrong because they can't break out of those intense emotions in order to just kind of relieve the pressure with, man, we just enjoy being around each other. So it's a good diagnostic to say, when was the last time you and your spouse or you and your kids in just had fun together, enjoyed together? Like that would be a sign. If you can say, yeah, we did, we laughed together, then it's like, okay, whatever your problems are, you can deal with them. because there's some there's some substance there. If you go, I can't remember the last time my wife and I laughed together, it's always tense. Then I would say, okay, that now it's time to start pushing the emergency button and, you know, go talk to a pastor, get some other eyes on it and try to dial down to where you can recover that freedom and that humility that breeds playfulness and camaraderie in a household or in a community.
Now, are there ways to help train us for those decisive moments in the everyday little moments? Like you said, one of the best things to do is to just act. How do we see the everyday little things, perhaps the small decisions or the small actions, helping to be a training ground for when we need to be sober-minded in the big things, like when Aaron is facing the golden calf idolatry or Paul is facing Peter, as you talk about in the book?
Yeah, that's good. I do think there's something to the danger of a kind of paralysis. I felt this at various times in my own life, I think, where you feel like I'm not exactly sure what the right thing is to do, and therefore I'll just kind of, be passive. And that's a muscle. Like, it's weird that passivity can be a muscle, but like, you're training yourself to respond to minor hardships in ways that are not good. So like, when I think about my kids, I have three sons, the older two are, in middle school and high school. And I'm trying to get them, like, the push is, you need to take ownership. Right. Don't sit around and wait for me. Like, you need to take ownership. This is what you need to do. Take the step. And it needs to, and sometimes it's a small step. Like, your response, it's the, this is the Jordan Peterson sort of, make sure you're, making your bed.
Clean your room, buddy. Yeah.
In your room, buddy. Like, exactly. So, there is something to that, because what it is it's a small way of, in Christian terms, of taking dominion. Right. Like, I'm taking, this is my space and I own it and I'm taking ownership of it. That kind of little thing is, it's like a muscle. And this is how, classically, theologians and philosophers have thought about virtue, is there's a habituating dimension to it the practicing of the virtue cultivates that disposition and that orientation, which then becomes more habitual. It becomes more a part of your character and not simply a one-off thing. And so I think those are the sort of the taking stock. I mean, at a simple level, it'd be like taking stock of the areas that God has entrusted to you. What are you over? And picking some small ways that you could do, take a little more ownership, right? And you don't have to get it right. I think, Doug Wilson has a great quote. He says, maybe pick this up somewhere else, but anything worth doing is worth doing badly. Correct. So, you're going to make mistakes, you're going to blow it. But better to take responsibility and take action than to simply wait for you to somehow magically become really good at whatever it is. This is, when I think about raising kids, right, this is part of what sports, I think, teaches them. It's like, the repetition, in practice is meant to condition your muscles in certain ways so that it's just second nature. You just know, you don't have to think about swinging the bat, you just swing. Right. But that comes from lots and lots of repetition. It's a similar thing, I think, in terms of leadership, is it takes practice. And for some of us who, maybe didn't have, parents who did this well or who were, whatever the situations are and don't have good models, it may take a little bit longer, but it's like God's patient. God's patient with you. He'll bring you along. The best thing to do is start, be faithful in little, and then God says, then I'll put you over more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is that kind of Jocko Willink extreme ownership. Mike Foster talks about this as well, always taking responsibility. Obviously this is not a new problem, but it seems, and maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like there's more of the failure to take responsibility now than perhaps when I was growing up. And, I'm not that old. I'm 46. Some people will think I'm old, but I still don't think I'm old. But to what extent is this taught, or is it just caught? We talked about, the individual training, making sure that you're not disciplining yourself to not act, or mm-hmm. you're not training yourself to always be passive. But to what extent do you need people around you to see to come out of that mindset?
Yeah, I do think that's important. And I think, you know, the ideal circumstances are, you know, you grow up in a home where you see mom or dad practice it, and therefore it feels more like second nature because, well, of course, this is what men do. Of course, this is what dads do. In the absence of that, it's finding sort of surrogates because there is an element of it. It needs to be caught more than taught. You need to kind of witness it, experience it. You know, in order to become a better father, you kind of need to be fathered. And, you know, if you didn't have it when you were, you know, in your formative years, it means you're going to be relying on, you know, you might be a pastor who you're, or another man in the church that you admire, where you're kind of observing, how does he relate? And you're just imitating, you're saying, okay, that's, I'm going to be like that. And then, and then maybe running stuff by him, you know, like you find someone that you can ask for counsel and advice. And then I think the other piece, there's the father piece, but for men too, I think, there's the sort of peer level, like you need other guys that are kind of working the same problems and that you can kind of see them stumble their way through it. And there's a kind of brotherhood and camaraderie that comes from there. I think that's a really valuable thing as well, because you need an atmosphere so that it doesn't feel like you're just off on your own with no other inputs and influences to kind of boost it, encourage it, or discipline it if it begins to go off the rails.
Yeah. Is there, it seems like we live in an age that is kind of enchanted by the Turkish delight of coddling. And how do we get out of that coddling kind of mindset to having a more courageous, moving forward with boldness, not in a reactive way, but in a measured, mission-oriented mission-oriented manner?
Yeah. So I think, you know, one of the main things that a head of home, head of church, head of business needs to do is figure out what's the purpose of this body that I am the head of? What's the mission of the family? What's the mission of the church? What's the mission of this business? Whatever. There needs to be some kind of mission clarity. And then there needs to be clarity about the head's role in relation to that. The head is the one that orders and structures the body for its purpose, and then seeks to empower and equip the other members of the body for their purpose. That's what you're there for. And you do that by your presence, you do it by your words, and you do it by your actions. So that's kind of where it starts. So getting clarity on what is actually the mission. And then as you're going through, realize there's going to be attempts of various kinds to kind of take you off mission, to derail that, to get you distracted. To get you, to steer you, to sabotage you. And the priority for a good head is don't lose sight of the mission, right? Don't feel like you, and I think this is where, like, in, you know, for pastors, this can easily become a thing where you begin to think, I don't really know, you know, you spend all your time doing things or reacting to things, and you're not actually leading the church where the church needs to go, because it's all reactive to controversies or tensions or conflicts. As opposed to going, nope, we're leading through those. We're managing those. We can't make them go away. We can't prevent them. I think sometimes pastors would love to be able to snap their fingers and go, no more conflict. And it's like, that's not going to happen. That's just not the world you live in. And so don't resent that, but instead say, okay, controversies are baked into the cake. So one of the, maybe a practical thing is in the book, I spend an extended time on Paul's final journey to Jerusalem. Because I think it's such a great example of him going in with a plan and then that plan going absolutely up in flames, like that, you know, he's going to try to make peace and like quell hostility and, you know, put to rest these lies that he hates Moses and he wants to, you know, wreck Judaism and he's wanting to put that to rest. And then like 5 minutes in and the whole thing is just one big chaotic mess. And I just love that Paul is not thrown by this at all, but he says, no, this is okay. I can use this. I'm still on mission here. I'm just going to use this as an opportunity to give my testimony and preach the gospel one more time. And so he doesn't see, oh no, it didn't work. He thinks, oh, God had a better plan. I'm going to roll with it and take every opportunity. He's sober minded. And so he can see opportunity where I think other people would just see chaos, confusion, destruction. Like they would say, this, it's over. It's over. Say, he's like, oh no, this is great. I'm going to just keep, do the next thing, do the next faithful thing. Can I have the microphone? You know, like that my favorite, one of my favorite parts of that story is when he just got beat up and they've, the police show up, the tribune with the centurion shows up and arrest him. He's getting beat up. And so naturally you arrest the guy getting beat up and pulls him aside and trying to figure out what's going on. Why are these people shouting all these things? And Paul says, could I have the microphone and speak to the people? I would like to talk to them. And the tribune is like so blown away, it seems, by this. He goes, okay. And so Paul goes out there and he's like, I would like to give my testimony now. I would like to tell you about what has happened to me. And he's doing it in flawless Hebrew, which surprises everybody because they didn't expect the, you know, Greek loving, Gentile loving guy to know how to speak Hebrew. And so they're gone. Their expectations are being upended. And so they're just hushed into silence. And he's going, I'm going to talk to them about what Jesus has done for me. And so he saw it as opportunity, whereas I think other people would have gone, oh no, we blew it. And I think that requires a certain kind of, it's confidence in God. God is the, you know, the stability of our souls. We're grounded in the gospel. So that's like underneath our feet. And then therefore, when the plans get totally disrupted, we're not thrown. We just go, oh, God has a better story. We'll walk this story instead.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So like moving forward, I've gotten a great deal of, I put it this way. I've learned a lot from like Doug and you, Mike Foster, a bunch of Reform guys. And, you know, I'm Lutheran. We have a common enemy, and I think we've always had a common enemy. But I think in years past in America, perhaps, and maybe elsewhere, though I think we were more separated by you know, country or locale, we would see each other as enemies. You know, that we were vying for the same people. We were trying to get the same people in the door, so to speak. So our arguments were, or our sermons were tailored to, this is why our doctrinal position is correct and why theirs is wrong. How do we get out of this mindset in an age where really we have an enemy to fight, a common enemy to fight?
I think this is one of the adjustments that people are really, some people are making it more easily, and I think some people are taking a little more time. But sort of in Christendom conditions, by which I mean in social conditions in which biblical morality, the biblical vision of morality, is sort of assumed at the bottom. That's sort of the baseline of society, and everybody in the society is operating in terms of that biblical perspective. And then on top of that, then you're going to have your various flavors of, you know, theological disagreement. So you get your Lutherans or your Presbyterians and your Baptists and your Pentecostals. In those kind of conditions, it makes a lot of sense that you would be, that the arguments and debates would be over like, well, what do you think about the Lord's Supper? Should, you know, how, who do you baptize and who do you not? All of those questions make sense when that kind of fundamental moral order, and not just the moral order perhaps, but also then the solution to our breaking of the moral order, the gospel, is sort of baked in, then those are the debates you'll have. I remember in college, those were the sorts of debates that I was having with folks, you know, 20 plus years ago. In an environment in post-Christendom here, as we've entered into this, this negative world, where that foundation is not in our common in our society, the adjustment that needs to get made is anybody who still shares that common moral framework and gospel framework is far closer to me than anything else. And while that, you know, so it's like, and that we ought to be sort of working together so that we can get back to the days when we could argue about baptism. Like that would be a target. Like if we could get back to where the debates are over the proper mode and timing of baptism, that would be a good thing, because it would mean that the condition, and then we might be able to move even farther up the list of things and come to more unity. Who knows? But in the present moment, In Christendom conditions, and I think the other thing about Christendom conditions is it allowed certain groups to kind of, just kind of ride. Somebody else built the thing and they're just riding in it, right? Uh-huh. So they don't feel a responsibility to maintain it. I think in particular, this is how I've kind of understand some of the Baptist political philosophy stuff that I've wrestled with, has been, I think there's a fundamental divide here, is that Baptists didn't build Christendom, but their political philosophy was formed as sort of separatists within Christendom. Like they mm-hmm. were the, I always say like Baptists are the, but we really mean it people. So in a Christendom context, you could have people who are just box checking, you know, okay, I grew up, I was baptized. I'm just box checking this. I don't really believe it. And mm-hmm. Baptists are going to come along and be like, no, but you have to mean it, which is a great, that's absolutely right. And that'd correct. Be true of Baptists and Congregationalists and other kind of separatist groups in the history of Christendom that were basically saying, hey, we don't like nominalism. We have to really mean it. And it's like, yes and amen. Well, because of that, when Christendom falls apart, and you need to like, now the goal is how do you rebuild a social order that honors God and that allows the gospel to flourish? It's hard to make the shift for some traditions mm-hmm. because their whole identity was bound up in being the dissenters within Christendom. And now there's no Christendom. So now what? Well, you got to start rebuilding. Oh, mm-hmm. we don't have those muscles. We haven't flexed those in a while. We maybe never in our tradition had to flex those. We've always been sort of the minority, the separatist minority. And it's like, well, now all of us, culturally speaking, are this minority, and we need to work together to build all, you know, the build the city of God. Like we need to, so you know, whether it's common enterprise in you know building you know Christian schools or other you know civic efforts in order to create context for people to live and work and the church to evangelize. Those are places where I think kind of a Protestantism is helpful in this way because it allows us to say, hey, the gospel is the fundamental thing. And if you get that right, there are places where we differ and maybe we can't be in the same church or congregation or denomination, but we're still going to see each other in heaven. And therefore we're on the same team, like you said. And yeah. So I think that's the kind of shift that says, hey, if someone's on the same team in that respect, then we ought to be able to work together in order to create, to rebuild the ruins that we yeah. find ourselves in.
Yeah. I'd like to see us be able to, you know, over, you know, some bourbon and cigars or beer and cigars, argue those finer points that we disagree on, but like publicly at least have some sort of like unified, look, we agree on some of these fundamentals.
Right. Yes, that's absolutely right. Yeah. And I think, you know, what's the old joke? Like, it doesn't matter what you think the differences are between you, you're going to be in the same gulag.
You know? That's true.
Like, you know, and so maybe maybe it won't be over beer and cigars. It'll just be arguing in the bus on the way to the gulag that, you know, the rainbow, when they send us off to rainbow reeducation camp, like we can debate the finer points of baptism, but like we should have that mentality of like, again, for me thinking, you know, sort of as a, you know, my first, I don't know, I'm a Christian and then I'm a Protestant, right? So I'm a Protestant. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you know, it's Presbyterian or something like, but that's down on the list. And so thinking as a Protestant, it enables me to say that the image, that we use around here in Moscow a lot is that Nehemiah rebuild the ruins of the city. And so we're, you know, you got a sword in one hand and the trowel or the shovel in the other. Mm-hmm. And so you're building and you're fighting, right? That's the kind of image that we lean on. And I've got we ought to have a big category for, okay, we're building here on our little portion of the wall, but somebody over there is also building and fighting on their portion of the wall. And that means that we're on the same team, engaged in the same project, maybe doing it differently, right? Our wall may have a little bit of a different flair than your part of the wall. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. God's cool. God's fine with that. Mm-hmm. But the issue is you shouldn't start fighting other people on the wall. Not when there's, you know, enemies of God harassing and trying to derail the whole rebuilding effort. It's a really bad look if there's a whole bunch of folks who are supposed to be building and fighting the enemy are instead squabbling, you know, on the wall. That's not what you want in this kind of moment, in this situation.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your time, Dr. Rigney. Really enjoyed this conversation. I've enjoyed your books. Where can we find more about your passions and what you write about?
Yeah. So, I'm on Twitter, Joe_Rigney, is my handle on Twitter. If you're interested in the new book, emotionalsabotage.com is where you can pick that one up. Beyond that, you know, I've got articles at Desiring God that go back a number of years. And now you can find me a lot on Canon Plus, as we've moved to Moscow and are ramping that up. So those would be a couple of places.
Excellent. Well, again, thanks so much for your time, and blessings out there in Idaho.